Peter.
I was going to ask him, this is a little bit on the side, but it made me think about, what was Bill Wilson's experience with his fourth and fifth step?
What was Bill Wilson's experience with his fourth and fifth step?
Mm-hmm. Who did he do his fifth step with? Did you ever talk about it?
We down the road, where, yeah, we can give you a short, right? Bill Wilson, I'll give you a real quick. The big book had just been printed, and it wasn't selling worth a toot. The mortgage company had finally taken away their home there at 182 Lincoln, Clinton Street. They'd been living around with two or three different AAs. AA had just, in New York, finally got enough people and organized to the point they needed a central place to meet, so they went down at 24th Street. They bought, used to be the Illustrators Club. Before that, it was a stable. And they got two guys, Horace Crystal and Bert Taylor, got together. They had some money, and they guaranteed the rent at $75 a month. They hired old Tom to be a coffee maker and caretaker and whatever. There were two bedrooms and a bath upstairs, and Bill and Lois moved into this little bit. They had an orange crate for their dresser, and that was it. Bill was not in good circumstances in November of 1940. The book wasn't selling. He was living off these people and everything. He had his first pigeon out of town's hospital, Hank, was drinking again. His good buddy, Ebby, who had brought the message to him, was drinking again. Bill was having what he called imaginary ulcer. He didn't even want to get out of bed. It was late at night. It was sleeting and snowy. About 11 o'clock at night was one of the stories I've heard at what time. Old Tom comes upstairs, says, Bill, there's this bum down here. He just showed up from St. Louis. You want to talk to him or not? And Bill thought, my instinct was to wave him away, but I'd say, okay, come on up. I don't talk to him. And he heard him bumping up against the walls and stumbling on the stairs and stuff, and the guy walked into his room. He took off his coat and he had on the Roman collar of a Catholic priest. He said, I'm from St. Louis. I'm a Jesuit priest. My name is Father Edward Dowling. I'm the editor of the Queen's Work, which is the magazine for Jesuits throughout the country there. I've just come across my desk here, this new book, this Alcoholics Anonymous thing. Now, I've been in Akron, and I've talked with Dr. Bob and some of them boys and everything. They told me I'll come see you. I'm interested. What do you know about the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius? The spiritual exercise, this is what the Jesuits use to go through a set of steps and practices to get a conscious contact with God. He asked Bill Wilson, he said, what do you know about those spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius? And Bill Wilson said, Saint who? And Dowling lit up like a Christmas tree. He knew then that Bill Wilson didn't copy these. That this was a divinely inspired thing, independently arrived at, and he had hit a gold mine. Bill Wilson, after discovering he wasn't a drunk, and after talking for a little bit and finding out the reason he was stumbling and all of the noise coming up there, was because Father Dowling had polio as a child, and it was the pain never went away. A crippled man. And through this pain, he had achieved a degree of depth in spirituality and understanding that it was his personal crisis. Bill Wilson, of course, his personal crisis was alcoholism. They immediately connected. And it was that night, Bill Wilson says, it was that night that I gave my fifth step. And Edward Dowling became his spiritual mentor. He called him his spiritual advisor. They stayed in constant contact. That when Bill wrote the 12 and 12, he ran it by Dowling to see what you think about it, you know. And there's an excellent book out right now. Father Fitzgerald finally, as he published the Ed Dowling letters, the correspondence between Bill and Ed Dowling.
What's the name of that again?
Huh?
What's the name of that again?
The Soul of Sponsorship. By Father Fitzgerald. He's out of Minnesota.
He's from Minneapolis.
Minneapolis.
He came up and spent a day with me.
Yeah, I've got a preliminary, some of the research he was putting together is pieces on that, and he's finally, we got to get that book, because I imagine it's just hot off the press.
Amanda here.
Yeah, I was under the understanding that later, you know, after he met Father Dowling, that Dowling was his spiritual advisor, but I was always felt that he did a fifth step with Ebby even before his spiritual experience, because here in Bill's story, on page 13, it says, my schoolmate visited me when he was at the hospital, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. We made a list of people I had hurt or towards whom I felt resentment, but it goes on and on, where Bill was actually taking all these steps without even knowing it.
There's, we do notice about Bill, sometimes he gets things out of sequence, and he's trying to make important points. He's trying to keep some sort of chronological order here, although it may not have happened in exactly that order. He's trying to help a person who is just trying to quit drinking. he's making it as simple as he can, but the exact chronology may not be accurate. Another question is, I know where you're headed, Peter. We've had this discussion before. Did Bill Wilson actually do a written fourth step? It's mentioned in that book three times, written for step, written for. There is no piece of paper anywhere that Bill Wilson was surviving, that Bill wrote out his four step. There is no surviving piece of paper I've ever seen that any of those first 100, and there were more than 100, by the way, ever wrote out a four step. Did they or not? I don't think it really matters. When Bill wrote those steps as to what to do, what he was doing was distilling the best possible experience. He got an intuition that to write this down would even help to reveal more, to see it on paper. Hey, maybe I didn't exactly do that, but I'm going to tell you it'll be a lot better to do it that way. And maybe three or four of them tried it, and they said, oh, Bill, you got to tell them written, because, man, when I did it, it was so it's written. Yeah, it's a case of don't do as I did, do as I say, because I've now improved it. What they did was to distill the best possible. Had they all done each and everything? I don't know, and I don't really think it matters. What I do know is, when I speak from personal experience, and this is not an opinion, I did those things. And what I've got out of them, I can't even describe them to you in the words of the English language, which is a very proficient language in itself, and that isn't enough. My message is, they say, carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a message. It's in three parts. The first part is, I couldn't quit drinking. The second part is, I did those 12 things. As a result, I became spiritually awakened. Oh, yeah, somewhere along the line, this drinking stuff quit. It just kind of went away by itself. And the third part of the message is, this could happen to you. The precision of whether they did or not somehow loses all of its importance in the personal miracle that has occurred in my life because I did them that way. We got Bill Dotson, then we got all the way up to AA number 3. Where are we going?
We've only got a few more pictures here. Oh, okay. Here comes Abby Goldrich. We made some brief mention to him before. Abby decided to get sober. He went down to Akron. He got met with Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob put him in hospital. That was a very common practice in those days. Dr. Bob put you in hospital. This was a drying out thing. It wasn't a treatment center or anything. Medically detox you, and the big deal there was to catch you and have medical supervision there if you had those ETs, because, I don't know, but they tell me withdrawal from the drugs is just terrible, just pull your hair out, a bad experience. But there is a difference between an alcoholic, he goes into DTs, and he dies. That's why a detox center, any treatment center today, you're not going to get, at least in Illinois, you don't get licensed unless you've got an MD. They're
either on hand or immediately available. Dr. Bob put him in the hospital and watched him while the hospital. Well, anyway, Abby decided to get sober. He's in the hospital down at Akron with Dr. Bob. Abby's wife says, "Oh, is there anything I can do?" Clarence says, "Yeah, you know, we're about to start a meeting of our own up here in Cleveland. How about using your house?" She says, "Sure." There's Abby still in the hospital. When Abby gets out of his hospitalization and goes to his first meeting, he doesn't have to wonder about where it is or somebody to come pick him up and take him to it because it's in his own home. There's Marty Mann. You hear her referred to sometimes as the first woman in AA. She is not the first woman in AA. There were women in AA before Marty. They didn't stick. And you also sometimes hear Marty Mann is the first woman in to get and stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Her story in the big book is Women Suffer Too. And that's not true either. Marty has flipped. Ethel, that would make Ethel Macy then the first woman to get and stay sober, right?
Probably.
Okay. From farm to city, that was her story. And Marty came into I have trouble putting her in this category of pioneers in the first 100. She came to her first meeting, and she made a comment in an interview where she said, "At that meeting, I met Bill and Lois there at Clinton Street, and they showed me this this big book." I don't know whether she was talking about the manuscript before it actually came out, or was did she really see an actual copy of this red book here? Whether she was into, I'm going to call her date of sobriety April 39, and that's a nice round figure, but whether she was in before that big book was published or not, there is question. And even though Bill wrote in the Grapevine article that she first continuous sober, stayed sober late, she herself admits the three slips. She says, you know, they were very short, and I never left AA. Now you're getting into some technical definitions. What is a slip? And you get to define that stuff yourself, so I'm going to let Marty have all the leeway room she was. Later on, she's highly intelligent, very literate, very she's a wordsmith like Mel here, and she was connected with some very powerful, wealthy friends. The idea came up that this new discovery that alcoholism is a disease, not a morally bad person, should be spread, should be shared. If people in the United States, if the opinion could change from a moral issue into it's just like tuberculosis or cancer, except those people don't take down their pants and go naked into the fountain and stuff, you know? He decided to start the national, what we today call the National Council on Alcoholism. She caught an awful lot of heat because in the process of this, she was going to have to break her anonymity. Marty got crucified for this. Well, if you dig into it a little bit further, you're going to discover that both Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob went to Marty with this idea. Both Bob and Bill said, "Break your anonymity. It's understandable. This is a good enough purpose. If it needs to be done, we encourage you to." She was hesitant, but geez, when Bill and Bob said, "Yeah, okay, fine." And they did, and this is before the tradition of anonymity ever came around, you see. This is their learning process. They're not bad people. They're becoming educated people. They did have a meeting with Marty a little later on, and both of them apologized. "We're sorry you got this heat. It was a bad idea. We shouldn't have done it. Cat's out of the bag. Can't put it by Pandora into the box again. And but look at the reason. Like, look at Claire. Look at the results here. National Council on Alcoholism today. Look at the understanding in America that it's not a moral problem. Gee, don't make any judgments on good or bad. Just follow it along and see where it leads."
I had a couple of things I wanted to say. The first thing I wanted to say is, what's wrong with taking down your pants and going into the fountain?
I
Well, they weren't really able to do that within the traditions of AA to publicize things, because Marty, with the National Council on Alcoholism, and it had another name the first year or so.
National Committee for the and we're not sure that they went to Marty. It's possible. See, Marty had the idea, or they were kicking it around over coffee someday. Where it actually began or started, we don't know. What I do know is that Bill and Bob encouraged her to break her anonymity, said this would be a good day.
Didn't
she get Bob and Bill's names on another letter?
That's right, and that was one of the controversies. Right.
Yeah, there was a letterhead that came out in support of this new National Committee on Education, and it listed Bill as the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was on AA letterhead stationery and implied direct support, and I believe it was to raise money, was it? And when that came out, it hit the fan. Bill just stayed out of the office because the letters and memos were stacked up three high, and there was a lynch mob out at the front door, see? And he made a real quick apology about that. That's when the anonymity came into play. That's when our understanding of non-affiliation became so important to us. Bill really caught his lesson.
Now, is psychiatric
Marty Mann was in a psychiatric hospital. Yes.
He was in a...
She was in Blythewood Sanitarium in Connecticut, and she was she spent about a year there at Blythewood, and she couldn't sober up. Neither could her later to become her brother-in-law, a fellow by the name of Granny, and they were pretty close, had the same problem. And her
I don't think Granny was her brother-in-law. I think Ty Miller was.
Not at this time, but Granny later married into this and became her brother-in-law.
Well, go ahead.
So what happened here was the psychiatrist, Terry Tebow, she originally went to Kennedy, I believe, and he said, I can't do anything about you or for you, but he recommended Tebow, and she ran across Tebow. And Tebow was one of the fellows that got one of the 400 original manuscripts to read and see what he thought of. He was a big enough name that they thought he might give. And he looked at that and he said, here, Marty, read this. And it took him about, he says it took him about 2 months to finally convince her to even read it. And she got so mad at it, she almost threw it right out the window. All this, she said, there's too many capital G's in here. too much God in here. But like so many times I've heard the story, there is a line in there that was intended for her. It doesn't mean much to me. The fear is what will kill us, kind of an idea. So what? It means nothing to me. John here, his dad, told me one time, I was getting out of the car on my very first 12-fifth call, and I was all hot to go, and I had this old buffalo with me. We were going to pick this guy right up, and on the way out, he pulled my shirt sleeve before I got out of the car, and he said, now remember, if it's his time, if it's been appointed, there's nothing you can say that'll be wrong. Don't worry about it. Oh, boy, I was really hot. And before I get my hand on the door handle, he said, oh, by the way, if it's not his time, you can't say anything right. That line in the big book was meant for Marty, and it just, the light bulb went on, and she said, I got to know more about these folks. So Tebow found out where the manuscript come from, who they were. And he said, oh, my, they're real local here. And he called us, and she got taken by Popsy Meyer. He never could stay sober himself, but he brought a lot of people into that early AA in New York, took her to her meeting, and that's where she gets introduced to Bill and Lois at Clinton Street and saw the book. She got sober on the manuscript brought her to AA. And Granny never, and then she went back to the sanitarium, and that's when she made her famous remark, Granny, we're not alone.
I'd like to say a few things about Marty. Because I knew her, and you have the tape that you copied where I interviewed her at her home in Easton, Connecticut. I think that was about the last year of her life. And I first heard Marty give a talk in Detroit around 1951. She came out there with people from the National Council on Alcoholism. And then again, she was our speaker when we had the Michigan State Conference in Jackson in 1960. And then several times down in New York, and also that experience at her home in Eastern Connecticut. But Marty took a lot of abuse, but some of it, she was a driving person, and she got things done, and I suppose when it came to AA, the way people criticized around the country, she invited some of this criticism, a few things she did. I'm sure she was aware of it. She was a very gracious person, an excellent speaker, and a nice-looking woman. Look, you know, you thought of her as maybe a department store executive or something like that when you saw her. She had lived over in France when she was drinking and been involved with some funny people over there. She described herself as having grown up and started drinking in the F. Scott Fitzgerald era in the
1920s. Marshall Field?
There was something about her family on Chicago, but her family, I think her dad had a drinking problem too, or something like that. But there were a lot of family troubles. But I also met her brother, a fine fellow that lives up in Toronto, and then her sister, her younger sister Betty, lived in Cleveland and was married to a fellow named Ty Miller. And I interviewed them, or Ty rather. So I knew a lot about the family. But I was in AA when she was taking some of this heat from members. And then later on, going into the archives, I saw some of the letters to Bill Wilson about Marty. And there were people from all over the country writing, talking about Marty getting rich, you know. And the poor woman almost didn't have enough to live on, you know, her income. People didn't really come out with a lot of money for the National Council on Alcoholism. That's been one of their problems right along. Nobody wants to give a lot of money for drunks. We had a fellow named Brink Smithers who just died recently, and he was a wealthy guy and a recovering alcoholic, and he gave a lot of money. He helped finance the move to Rutgers, from Yale to Rutgers, and all of that.
Did he finance the Learjet that they built down to
he
Miami?
He did, yes. When they took Bill down to Miami Heart Institute, it was Brink who leased the plane, taking down there. Pardon?
Yeah, the Smithers Institute in New York is in Brink.
And also Rutgers, he financed a lot of that. But except for people like that, there wouldn't have been any money at all. And the National Council on Alcoholism has always had financial trouble. There hasn't been a lot of money floating around there. Because people think, why should I give money for drunks, you know? Throw them, put them in jail, the bastards. You know? They've never been a real good fundraising outfit, and it's just because of the stigma of alcoholism.
Thank God
for self-supporting. Right. But Marty had this trouble. She never made a great deal of money, but these AA members thought she was, you know. And in some of her letters to Bill, she expressed despair, you know, over the trouble she was having, just keeping the organization afloat and all of that. But she left the council actively and then worked as a counselor at a treatment center in Connecticut for the remaining years of her life. And then she went around and spoke. And I talked also to a woman named Felicia, a very old-time member. But her story is in the big book. And interviewed her about Marty. And she would say Marty would come back from one of these trips where she would speak before a big crowd and get the standing ovations and everything. And she'd come back to her little group there in Connecticut and say, well, I've come back an oracle. Well, bring me back, bring me down to size. You always realize that ego and everything could take over. And the last time I heard her talk was down in New Orleans in 1980 at the International Conference. And then just a short time later, I was working at Libby on Ford then in the Public Relations Department, and our librarian came in and said, oh, one of the founders of AA died. And I thought, who was that? And she had the clipping. Marty from the New York Times.
And we give Clarence hell about being, you know, calling himself a founder and stuff. The ability for the press to stretch things is just phenomenal.
Well, I don't know if that's what it said. It was something like that. But then Marty had died. Marty had a lot of trouble with depression. And she told me that she had trouble with her tear ducts and everything because the medication she took for her depression had dried up her tear ducts. They didn't work right and all of that. And she just got that kind of straightened out about the time she passed on. She was 75, I believe.
And, everybody that I've, when I get into Marty, man, it is consistent. I can say to you that this isn't an opinion. It is backed up by a lot. Everybody, sophisticated, lady, attractive, intelligent person, very highly complimentary. She had a presence. We talked about Dr. Bob and Bill having a presence. Marty Mann had a, when she walked in the room, said, "Who's this?" One more. He's not really in the first 100. By the time we get to Marty, we're at the end of the first 100. She might even be questionable, but we're going to stick her in the category. I'm going to call him AA number 101. Date of sobriety is May of 1939, so he's 1 month. There's probably a few others in here, but he's the only guy I got a picture, so I'm going to call him AA number 101. Ernie Gary, you probably know
him.
Well,
he was a friend of mine, yes. Of course, he was one of the founders of AA in Toledo, and he was living only 30 or 40 miles from Toledo in Adrian, Michigan, when he passed on. So one of the great things I remember about Ernie is that he liked my grapevine article. So that makes him okay.
Ernie made a reference, an interesting reference, that he remembers Dr. Bob going to Oxford. He was from Worcester, Ohio.
Yeah.
And he remembers Dr. Bob traveling over to Worcester, Ohio, to the visiting Oxford group meetings over there long before there was any Alcoholics Anonymous. He was an Oxford grouper.
Yes. Ernie, the first meeting Ernie ever went to, Ernie and his wife Ruth both went to this meeting, and it was in the Williams home on Palisades Drive. And then they also, Dr. Bob put Ernie in the hospital. But Ernie stayed there only one day. It says $6 a day, that was pretty expensive, you know. And Ernie was a salesman living, I think, in Worcester, like you said. But he said as they were going, after they left the meeting, Ruth turned to him and said, "Well, in spite of all the smoking and cussing at that meeting, I think there was more Christianity there than I've ever seen." Something like that. And Ruth is gone now, too. But we have them on tape and a lot of memories of them in Toledo. But there were 8 people that started AA in Toledo in 1940, and Ernie was the one of them, and probably the spark plug.
They call him Ernie Jesus II, if you ever see that reference in some of your readings, that because Ernie Galbraith, that's Ernie G, and then Gary in here came in so closely in there, they had troubles, which Ernie, I do the same thing, you know, back at where I've come from, we've got New John, Little John, Big John, Old John, Funny John, and you got to kind of distinguish these guys somehow. Another reason for last names here, you got to know who you're talking about. Is that pretty much the, we brought the major hitters there. That's a little brief overview.
Can I ask a question? Maybe you guys can do like a mini lead or something. Tell your story a little bit. Because I don't know anything about you, Mel, other than you wrote these books. And I'd like to hear a little bit of your story. And George, I'd like to hear a little bit of your story.
We talked about doing that, but it does turn it into an AA meeting. It's not very historical. And besides, we don't want you knowing a lot about it. There's so much history that needs to be put down here. And that's one of my main complaints about Mel. He'll go out and he'll give his lead and stuff and everything, and I'll sit there in the audience and say, "Oh, give me some of this AA history stuff," you know, and he goes into his story. I love his story. But I want to hear the history here, you know. Yeah.
I don't know how long it's out, but could we hear a little more about Google's depression? There's a lot about that.
dabble with the LSD, and then I heard some people say niacin and B vitamins and all that, but obviously this depression went away, and, you know, can you tell us a little more about that?
I'll take that. When I met Bill Wilson and finally talked to him for the first time, I'd heard him talk before. I hadn't met him, but in Akron in 1956, he was out there at the Founders Day, and I think he gave a talk in Goodyear Hall on Market Street or something like that, Main Street, or he told me to write him a letter. I wanted to ask him some questions, so I got this long letter back from him, which I still have. And he said the last 12 years of his life, now this is that he had been in near suicidal depression two-thirds of the time or something like that. He talked about that a little bit. And that's where he also discussed Aldous Huxley and mentioned Aldous Huxley's book, Heaven and Hell, where Aldous Huxley talked about mescaline. That's some kind of a drug, you know. And, well, that really burned me up. You get this letter and discover that Bill Wilson suffered from all of this depression. He had no right to be depressed, you know. He was the guy up there on the pedestal, the guy who had written the 12 steps. And where are we if the guy who wrote the 12 steps can't overcome depression? What problem do we have here, you know? I was really quite upset about that, and didn't really like him a little bit before that. Bill was supposed to be a lot more perfect than that, I guess, in my mind. And then later on, we got so that it was known around AA about Bill's depression and having gone to see Peeble, a psychiatrist, about the problem, and so on, and it got to be accepted. And then I talked to Nell Wing about it one time, and she said Bill had finally decided that his depression had a physical root. To a great extent. When I was working on the manuscript for Pass It On, what became Pass It On, I had a long chapter on his depression, and I culled through the letters that he had written on the subject. And if anybody had depression and they wrote to Bill, he would write right back to them and give them some suggestions. And he described depression as a problem that will cure itself over time. That you stay depressed and live long enough, why, pretty soon it will ease. And his depression had eased in about 12 years, and he'd had some very profound depression. In fact, at times they were so bad that he could just all he wanted to do was lie down and face the wall. But then he would determine that walking helped him a lot, taking walks. He was quite a walker. And when he'd go up to Vermont, for example, he would walk around in the mountains up there. And so he would decide to go out and walk a quarter of a mile. And he'd walk a quarter of a mile, and then he'd decide to do another quarter of a mile. See, he was doing this step at a time. And that helped him. And he felt that his walking and just taking those actions saved him from just completely losing it all together. Well, then this book came out in 1975, Bill W. by Robert Thompson. Boy, there was a lot of depression in there. That wasn't a very uplifting book, you know. And in fact, I imagine a lot of people might have read that and said, well, what in the hell did he gain by getting sober? there was so much of the depression. And what we're looking for, of course, all of us, we're looking for happy sobriety. We talk about the absolute necessity of staying away from the first drink, but we don't want to lay around in depression either. See, we want to function. And the thing that encouraged me the most in writing about Bill's depression was the way he worked on it, the way he kept trying to overcome it, and the way he was always willing to help other people. He wrote some very nice letters to different people around the country and gave his suggestions. And these letters, really, I don't know if they've been reproduced yet, but they were in the manuscript I submitted. Well, I understand that when they looked at my manuscript, they said there was entirely too much in there about the depression. See? And I thought I'd dealt with it very well in the one chapter. But so they changed that all around. And then there's also the deal about the niacin. He became convinced, he took part in these LSD experiments, which were supposed to have been trying to find something that would help alcoholics. And I never liked this part of Bill's story very well, and I never fully understood it. The niacin, the vitamin B3, they call that mega vitamin, close to something like that, where you just take massive doses of these vitamins, this vitamin B3, and the darn stuff will cause you to flush, you know, your face to turn red and everything else. And but Bill, in these papers, he wrote about all this. And this was in working with these two doctors, Hofer and Osmond, Humphrey Osmond. And these two guys had come up with this mega vitamin, of course.
And these were the LSD guys.
Yeah, they were the LSD guys. And but they'd come up with this mega vitamin, of course. It was supposed to overcome depression. And Bill, of course, he just became an enthusiastic advocate of it. And he started using the central office mailing stuff out, and they even asked him not to do that. So he had to open up another little office where he did that. And he wrote three papers on it, which George has here, and we're right here, rather. And these are, and he was almost more enthusiastic in these writings than he was when he wrote the AA stuff. Now, the thing about Bill is he was a cause guy. When he got a cause, and we believed in it, he could push it with all kinds of enthusiasm and convince people how important it was. And so some people followed his mega vitamins approach, and boy, it just did wonders for them. But I talked to Marty Mann, and she said, well, I took it, and it didn't do a darn thing for me. But I wonder myself, personally, if there wasn't a placebo effect here. And that anybody who took him, that was a real had Bill up on the pedestal and all of that, it started working because Bill Wilson had advocated to some of these people. But to Marty Mann, Bill was just this other guy, and she knew all about his clay feet and everything else. So she didn't get that effect from it. She took the stuff, and it didn't do anything for her, and that was it. So that's my personal feeling about that.
It was about 1960, somewhere about 61, Bill became interested in these doctors, this Hofer and this Osmond guy. They experimented with the potential of B3, niacin, sometimes called nicotinic acid of Massachusetts, as being helpful to alcoholics and schizophrenics. And Bill exhaustively studied their research. As you see, until now, Bill had been pursuing a spiritual angle of alcoholism. And now here's a possible medical, chemical aspect that's just intriguing. And their research seems to demonstrate, if you read into some of that, of course, you know, research is kind of like statistics, you know, numbers can't lie, but liars can, you know, numbers can't figure, liars can figure. The B3 helped them to sober up that it had been, they'd been unsuccessful with any other method, which presumably would include AA, maybe, Bill came to believe that they had possibly found a cure for the exact nature of this allergy, the chemical mix that Dr. Silkworth had first described to him over 25 years ago at Sounds Hospital, you see. Bill came to understand this allergy theory of Dr. Silkworth as an imbalance of blood sugar, particularly low blood sugar. And here, incidentally, we've got to point out, it's now well established that most alcoholics do have low blood sugar levels. That's a mild insulin shock. Hypoglycemia is what it is. So these two doctors demonstrated that B3 did, to some extent, help prevent a drop in blood sugar levels. And Bill caught that immediately. Additionally, that this B3 it wasn't a mood-altering drug like the LSD he had investigated. That even intrigued him further. This is a vitamin. So he became convinced that B3 was helpful for depression, and something that, you know, this has followed him ever since he sobered up. So he started his niacin campaign. It even rivaled his early enthusiasms that he used to promote AA back in the 30s and the 40s. He took B3. He convinced the girls in the office staff to take B3. He arm-twisted AAs to take B3. He convinced his friends to take, everybody ought to take B3, see? And these three papers then, these informational papers, are intended to promote research on niacin within the medical community. They're published by Bill. The first one here is by doctors who are AAs. The first one was sent out to doctors on AA stationery. See, Bill's enthusiasm for B3 is overtaking him here. By 67, his enthusiasm and his promotion of this became a nuisance, an embarrassment to AA as a whole. Not that anything might be wrong with trying B3, or that any of these claims by the doctors or Bill. The problem was that Bill was hurting AA by violating his own tradition. Now, specifically 6, it says we never lend the AA named outside enterprises, and 10, it says we have no opinion on outside issues. So the Board of Trustees, in 1967, they accepted a General Service Conference recommendation that had 3 parts. One, Bill, stop using AA stationery when you're writing about B3. 2, no employee at the General Service Office could be involved in this project up front. And 3, all future inquiries about B3 will have to be sent to a completely separate address.
Yeah. We have three questions here, I think. 3 people want to know.
1, having read all the accolades, I think it's called Doors of Perception, I think part of the reason for the LSD was that they thought that perhaps it would open the mind to the spiritual experience, or a reproduction of a spiritual experience. I don't think it was all primarily for depression. And another thing, being a hypoglycemic myself, I long suspected that Bill had suffered from it, because I heard, and I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, that they took him off of coffee and sugar, which is a partial answer. I heard it somewhere. But anyway, I had one sponsor that did think that hypoglycemia caused his alcoholism. He got his hypoglycemia under control, drank and died. I suspect that it might be the other way around, that the abuse that we give ourselves over the period of our drinking might cause the hypoglycemia rather than the hypoglycemia causing the alcoholism. They're separate entities as far as I'm concerned. And I went through 10 years of hellish depression myself because of my hypoglycemia. It had nothing to do with up front with my alcoholism, other than I think the alcoholism might have caused the hypoglycemia.
That's really a good point, Peter. And anytime anybody thinks that they're correcting the allergy or whatever it is, I think they're on an logical assumption then is, why can't I drink again? And that's what happened to you, Fred. Yeah. We got about 4 people.
And we got about 3 minutes left on about how much, John?
We've got about 10 minutes.
About 10 minutes left on the page.
Well, we had Peter there, and then you had a question.
I talked about there's the 6 steps. I think the story in the back of the book, he said that they used the 6 steps in the Lord's Prayer. And then, was that really the 4 absolutes? Was there ever really something that was the 6 steps?
But well, those 6 steps.
We covered that a little bit earlier when you were asleep, Peter. if you want to buy the tape here, we'll be more glad to.
you had a question, didn't you?
Peter, everybody's 4th step is just a little different.
It was mentioned and passed on that his depression basically left him in 1955 when AA came of age, and that most of his depression that he thought or it was expressed in the book, the opinion was his struggle to bring AA to where it was in 1955 when he kind of let go of the reins. His depression ended after that.
Well, there's some. That's a good thought, but you know, Bill told me, and I think he's often said this to other people, that the happiest part of his AA experience was the first 6 years. And that's when they were completely broke, and that's when the struggle was the worst. So, logically then, he should have been more depressed than ever then. I think really Bill was the sort of guy that
depression and things like that didn't bother him when he had something that really turned him off, you know. I think that when he could be depressed, but if somebody called him to give a talk somewhere that was very important to AA, he could get out of bed and go make that talk, see? And I think if he had some project, just like the best thing about this niacin project, I think, is the way it turned him on. Not the damn niacin itself, but the fact that he had something he could work on. And he was a driver, a guy, an entrepreneur of sorts, and by gosh, things like that turned him on and got his battery running.
You went through the archives there and made a chronology of all of the Bill Wilson trips, where he went and when and what time, tried to follow Bill as he went all over the country. And there was a time period in there where they were writing letters to say, no, Bill can't come talk here, and no, he's really resting, we're terrible, and he needs to revitalize his batteries and stuff. Yeah. But during that time period, Yale had asked him to come talk about the medical aspects of alcoholism, and boom.
He was there,
He was there. You know, we've got, Bill and I had started thinking from here we might go on into actually writing the book, get into the history and get the book written and everything. We don't have enough time to do this. These questions are phenomenal. I'm going to suggest with the hour that we may have left here, we can turn this into a general discussion. Just add, because the questions are great and you're popping all over the place. We're not able to follow any sort of order here and everything.
When we come back, we've got Tex and Linda.
We'll do that. We'll just turn the last hour into a question and answer. But we will, I'm going to ask, please try and focus your questions to asking about historical facts and to cleaning up the accuracy of the facts. We could quite easily deteriorate. This happens to my home group all the time, so I know it's possible. We could quite easily deteriorate into a whole bunch of opinions, you know. Let's don't waste the resource that we have sitting next to me here, you know. We ought to take a couple more. We've got about 5 minutes left on the tape.
Okay, we'll run this one out. Tex and then Linda.
I was wondering if I could have a minute with the opinion sign up.
Okay.
And this is about medical problem, medical questions in AA. And I spent a lot of time chasing everything. Allergies. And I reached a conclusion that trying to figure out the physical side of alcoholism is like putting together a jigsaw puzzle when you got way too many pieces. You know, I worked with an allergist once who spent 2 or 3 years developing a fantastic theory of alcoholism and allergy, and he may even be right. But what I found was that any medical specialist working in his field will always find something very significant in his field about alcoholism. Some of them have written books that have ruined their careers, you know, later, you know. The thing just...
I think,
get there from here.
Yeah, maybe one of the major points here is thank God AA doesn't care about that.
Yeah.
Well, we're not doctors, we don't care. The point of Alcoholics Anonymous is, if I'm going to paraphrase Alcoholics Anonymous if I could, screw the problem. Let's get into the solution, you know.
If I could be pardoned with a vulgarism, which is like trying to catch a fart. As a bad smell, there's nothing you get your hands on.
Very good.
Thank you for that scholarly dissertation on bodily function. Well, that's the end of the question and answer period. I'll tell you that right now.
Tom had a thunder back there. I have a couple questions. If you could say a little bit more about Emmett Fox and how his works influence AA. And a second general question, and maybe this falls into opinions, but maybe from your conversations with Bill and the early members, I've always heard a lot of discussion as to how soon and how often steps are to be worked. In the beginning of AA, was there an emphasis on do all these right away? You know, I've heard that in the beginning it was, in the first week they took their pigeon and they had them start writing out that fourth step and going out and making amends. And the last part of the question would be, in that same section of Pass It On, about Bill's depression lifted when he turned AA over, and he said some of his friends suggested Bill didn't work the steps himself.
You want to do the quick one on the box?
I said Dr. Bob, he took his ninth step the day he had his last drink.
All right. Yeah, I don't think that there was a, on these steps, Tom, you were talking about that, and I didn't get the last part I was thinking about.
Did Bill work the steps during his depression?
He tried to, yeah.
This gets and dangerously close yeah. to, boy, he wasn't perfect, so therefore he wasn't doing those tests.
Yeah, yeah, he would go to people, and they would tell him, well, work the steps. See, this is, and I remember when I was very young in AA, and I had lots of depressions, and I would talk about people, and some people would say, well, you must not be working the program in its entirety, see, stuff like that. Well, we don't say that to people anymore. And then as far as the steps, Bill wrote the steps because he was retracting what they've done. This is what we did. And then you get all kinds of opinions about how you work them, but Tex pointed out that Dr. Bob worked the ninth step when he got sober in June 10th of 1935. He went around and he saw the people. Now his big fear was of people knowing that he was an alcoholic. And then he was on the outs with some people. Some people had probably criticized him or rejected him and everything like that. So he just went around and saw all those people. And that was working the ninth step for him, but it was also facing that darn fear he had of other people knowing about his drinking. He'd even had a trouble admitting that to the Oxford group. These people, you know, that he told them that this may destroy my profession and everything else, but I'm a secret drinker or something like that. He was a secret drinker. A lot of people knew about it. But, and everybody there that was trying to help him knew about it. But he had trouble admitting these things. So he worked it right away.
Yeah, and his last bottle of beer that morning.
Yeah. Yeah. There, you know, I love the fellow that said, and I think it's particularly impacting because I'm the guy that said it. There's enough power in that first step to keep you sober if you don't wait too long to get to the second step.
Yeah.
There's enough power in that second step to keep you sober long enough if you don't wait too long to get to the... Now, the key to that all the way through there is everybody's got a different clock inside there, you know. It is true that in the very early phases, they emphasize get them done, do them now, moving right along. Remember what they're dealing with here in the early days, though, is the general Oxford group principles. They're not going to get codified into... They're still experimental with the procedure stuff yet. Dr. Bob, for instance, we have a letter by Bob Evans where he said, hey, I got on my knees while I was still in the hospital. I wasn't going to any meetings until I'd surrendered, and Dr. Bob thought it was an acceptable surrender kind of thing. Then they'd back off of that for a while. Then they'd emphasize it again. I've done this a lot of times myself when you get a new guy. You sense that he's ready to pop. He has maybe a strong religious background, and it's boom, he can go right now, hot dog, let's move on it. And the other guy, he's real resistant about any kind of higher power, and so you might want to let that wear a little bit on. His clock's different, you know. Yeah, in the early days, they tried stressing, do them all, do them right now. I want your fourth step in my hands by Friday, or you're not going to the meeting. But then they learned the individual personalities are going to be coming in here, and we're going to have to be a little gentler on a standard way that everybody has to. Remember also in the early days, there's just tremendous fear. Gee, we're not real sure if this is going to work. Our lives are at stake. Let's don't play around with it. As we go along and learn more, we get better. What? One more, Don? We got enough on the table for one more?
Tom's question relative to Bill and his depression. When he was in his depression, he says, I felt rather guilt-ridden that I wasn't working all the steps in some areas of my life. You know,
he admitted, you know, in his depression, that he felt guilty.
It's not the AA Bible, because we...
It has developed and changed over the years. Did Bill have any reservations about how it had changed, and did he have any big concerns about the future?
He was an observer, and he was love watching where it was going.
Well, he certainly must have had concerns, but he tried to prepare for that. And one advantage we have is he left lots of writings on all of these subjects. If we want to know what Bill thought, we can pretty much have it. It's all there.
I have a question about Bill Wilson's stocks, that he had bought stocks. So some people in AA think that Bill Wilson made all his money on the big book, and they were, you know, I heard there was controversy or something that he got real rich because of the big book, and there was people, and they invited him to a conference up at Cleveland, and he brought these documents saying, you know, that I didn't make this much money.
That's discussed in AA Comes of Age, and that was Clarence. Clarence was stirring that up, and Bill wasn't making a lot of money, but he was getting paid on the book, and Clarence was against that. I think what Clarence was really against was that he wasn't getting some of the money. I really feel that.
Bill made a comment. He said, well, the Board of Trustees just had another vote. They've raised the royalties I get on each. I'm making 50 cents a piece on each book. Now, what do you all think of that? And they all laughed and hollered. Bill didn't get... he was well off, but he wasn't like the multi-millionaire. Remember, the sales of these big books didn't really mushroom until you're talking into the 80s in there. Bill died in 71, for credit. Yeah. He did okay.
Lois got
yes,
rich.
But,
Lois did get rich.
Yeah.
But I talked to one trustee. The well, there were stocks in this Works Publishing Company, but those were given to the foundation. So there, Bill had no stocks. And I just wanted to say one thing more. One of the trustees was the president of the Ohio Power Company, a recovering alcoholic. And I interviewed him over in Cleveland, and I asked him about his feelings about Bill, his royalties, and he says, I think Bill earned every dime he got.
I'm going to point out here, Bill and I had a discussion before we started. Lots of groundwork was laid for this ever happened, and Mel was concerned. He said, oh my God, what are they going to think about, you know, if I brought some of my books to sell or something, that's, you know, the money in AA in it. And I said, Mel, shut up. Don't ever think about that again. The laborer is due his returns. Bill Wilson, thank God these people are making money on these books they're coming out about the history of AA, because this is the nature of the business. If they weren't, there wouldn't be any books. I said, Mel, these are historical references here. These people want them. They don't know where to go get them. They want more of you. You're providing a disservice by not letting the opportunity arise. I'm telling you here right now, I got an idea what Mel's making a piece off of these books here, and I can guarantee you he didn't come here today to get rich, okay?
But whatever it is, my wife will spend it.
Right.
One last question. It's the same question I asked you when I first met you, Mel. Did anybody read this? And I always thought Bill had said it, maybe in his letters or something. If AA is ever dissolved, it'll be from within and not from without. Now, where did I hear that?
Probably sometime back during the time of just right after the Washingtonians went down the tubes, you know. It's very interesting as an historian, if you observe the decline of any great movement or society or civilization, there is another thing besides that is common to all of them, besides they forgot where they came from. They didn't know it was happening at the time.
Maybe it's an AA Comes of Age.
Could be.
Does your concordance have it?
What's that?
Your concordance back there, is it in there? We always say that Bill, we quote Bill as saying, if AA is ever threatened, the threat will come from within. Or
it
something.
It is not in the big book.
Where is it? Bill sees it, or Grapevine, or something?
It's got to be in one of those. Are we making it up?
Yeah, I remember there's something about the Rome. The tax didn't come from the outside. It came from within. And maybe...
I asked John there at the GSO one time, I said, John, what's our greatest problem in AA today? This was quite a while back when Russia, the Iron Curtain was just coming down. He said, we have two. One's short-term, one's long-term. The short-term is being able to publish enough books and get them into Russia, but the really big one is the long-term problem.
I'll be back in a minute.
And our biggest problem is our success. He's hitting again back at the singleness of purpose, forgetting the spiritual roots and how it really worked, the introduction of psychology through the treatment centers in the last 10, 20 years we've had. AA will always be metamorphosizing into something. I asked Ernie Kurtz, I said, Ernie, you've written the definitive history of Alcoholics Anonymous. You and Mel, Bill Pittman, you guys have all been into, you've spent your lives researching the facts of the early AA, and I've been out there trying, I'm in the next generation coming along here. I've been trying, you guys have looked at all the trees in the forest here. You've picked over the bones, the little pieces I might be able to add are just so insignificant. What is the next generation going to do? What's their job? And he said, tell what happened to it.
Tell your story.
And now that provides me with the problem because it's still happening. Wow, and immediately I thought, oh, good Lord, you mean we need to write the obituary? He said, oh, no. And then light bulbs went on in me, and the next generation will tell what happened. We're still watching it.
Well, that's the purpose of this whole thing, is for the younger people to hear this, to pass it on to those that are still suffering, to those that are still practicing. And if we stop this, we will just dry up and blow away, like the old timer says. I have to stay green and growing. Either that or I'll just dry up and blow away.
You're more spiritually religious or Oxford group oriented folks would say, hey, did God want this thing? Look at the synchronicity. Did God want this thing to happen or not? Obviously he did. All right? If God don't want it no more, it's going to be gone. Who are you going to be to stop it? Lay back, relax, and watch the show. Meanwhile, don't have a drink and you might get better.
He's the director. Oh, we can do it right here.
I can't quote my source, but I think it might be Lois Remembers. But I'd like to bring up a business about Bill getting rich and all that. Bill went back to Wall Street somewhere in there, and he started making money that way too. But as the writer of the big book, he was entitled to a royalty. He did hold the copyright. And then after the money did start pouring in, I don't know if it was Bill or Lois, wanted to turn it back over to AA and say, I've got enough money, I don't need any more, you take it and keep it. But under the rules of AA, that would have been making a contribution over $500, and she couldn't do it.
I've heard that story before, too, and I go back to Ernie Kurtz. Where's your evidence? I've searched diligently for evidence along that line, and it is not out there. That they wanted to turn it back over and couldn't. That's not there. As a matter of fact, there's always been a history of Bill making arrangements and agreements with the board about these royalties and all of the tricky questions of it, and never coming to a written conclusion, always oral agreement. And then as Bill gets older and he realizes his own mortality, there's finally a push there at the end where we get it in writing, who gets what. The board was never really concerned with whether Bill deserved these royalties for his writing. That was never, ever anywhere in there. And you read some of those early records and the discussions were held in the executive sessions, the stories that came out and all that. Never concerned about Bill deserved this money. Their concern was he might be giving it in after he died. It may be winding up in some hands of some folks who hadn't worked real hard, didn't really deserve to. They were trying to attempt to control where it went after Bill, see. And they did finally, though. They worked it out. They set the royalties in stone. And then when Bill died, there's a will. It's all split up. And but no, Bill was always willing to accept his royalties. After all, Bill realized we need me out there working full-time on this. Let's face it. If it's going to save alcoholics all over the world, it needs a service center, it needs an office, it needs published literature, it needs some help and guidance from us. You know, Bill, there's a famous story about Bill in 55 at the International St. Louis when he made the big, I'm going to retire out of AA and going to turn over to you guys. We've come of age now. And even went through the whole physical thing. A great show. He stepped off of the stage, and they said it took him another 25 years to retire, you know, to actually make that last step to 14, 15 years. Yeah, he never quite got off the stage. And there was one comment about the fella who, years down the line, he was interviewed, and he said, well, I don't know who that guy is here at the General Service Office. That old codger back there in the back, you know. But when controversies rolled again, there was need for the old codger, you know. Those were the articles Mel was talking about. We don't defend ourselves. He always was a key player and knew he had to be. If he was going to be in there up front, he couldn't be a working stiff, you know.
Well, we've really come to the end now, I think, and this old codger's ready to call it quits, stepped out. We want to thank everybody for attending this, and this was our first experience. I don't know whether we're going to be invited to do this again somewhere or not, or what will happen, but we certainly appreciate, all of you folks have been really great.
It's a God deal.
And, yeah, and thanks a lot, and I hope all of you have a good trip home. And it was really nice meeting everybody. Shall we close the meeting?
Well, we just have to thank that audience out there. The depth and the understanding, the knowledge you folks have got at it was just tremendous, just almost electric. You folks were deluxe. And this open format thing, it's a really good vehicle, you know, for bringing out a lot of information. But I think more than that, it avoids that trap, keeps history from being too dull, you know. You can just kind of start anywhere, and wherever we wind up, well, that's where we are. It's enjoyable. It's almost even relaxing. Matter of fact, it's so relaxing, I'm going to wrap this up right now. If you gained anything here from our information, if that helps you to keep the spirit of those founders and those pioneers alive, I might suggest then that you pass it on.